Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the tragic events in Aurora, Colorado have sparked new discussions on gun control and homegrown terrorism. Will the government take a hard look at this, or will there be knee-jerk reactions? Breaking news out of D.C., the Congressional Budget Office has issued an opinion on the financial savings associated with the Affordable Care Act. What are the ripple effects of this study? The International AIDS Conference is being held in Washington, D.C. this week. Why is this important, and what is America's role in all of this? The turmoil in Syria has now reached critical mass. Chemical weapons and all, how dangerous is the Syrian issue and the Middle East? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Emmy Award-winning broadcaster, Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
How do you do, sir?
Very, very Emmy voice, too. Very nice. To his left, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is a longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and very handsome, and his title is Distinguished Fellow. At the Stinson Center, he is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good.
Thanks. Looking very distinguished today, too.
It gets harder and harder.
I know it does. To his left, to my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, longtime Vice President of Government Affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Good. And to my right, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, how are you?
Doing great. Glad good. To be on the show.
Good, good. Normally, we would be a lot more lively in our introductions, but based off of the current situation, it's hard to be really jubilant about the stories that we're talking about today. Obviously, the story that's gotten everybody's attention over the weekend, a tragic story out of Aurora, Colorado, where a individual went into a movie theater during a midnight showing last Thursday, early Friday morning in Colorado, went to a midnight showing of the new Batman movie, and in a theater basically started unloading handguns and high-powered rifles. Total of 12 fatalities. And that is of the last count. Over 50 were injured, some very critically. The question of the critical nature of those injuries are still being looked at right now. But it was a terrible, terrible situation of what happened. Basically, a 24-year-old man, James Holmes, originally out of California, went in dressed in full tactical gear, and also in an attempt to either divert or do harm to law enforcement, had an elaborate, it's the only word I can think of, an elaborate booby trap set up in his apartment involving chemicals, incendiary devices, and so forth. It is a continuously developing issue right now, but so many questions come of this. Number one, obviously, all of us here at Backroom Politics, our thoughts and our prayers go out to the victims and those who are still suffering throughout this ordeal. The injured and the wounded, we wish you a speedy and strong recovery. But so many questions have come up as a result of this. One of the big questions is, and Alan Moore, I'm going to start with you. A lot of people are starting to armchair quarterback this, but the big question is this something we should have been able to catch and see previous to this event?
Boy, I sure don't know how. I mean, this guy was a crazy person. That's obvious. Whether he was legally insane or not, that'll be left to a jury. But when people are acting odd, and we've all known oddballs, present company accepted, of course, but we've all known strange people, and then every now and then somebody who turns out to have been strange does some terrible, horrible thing. This guy apparently had some strange behaviors, but he hadn't been threatening people. He hadn't been doing anything. You know, there's talk about the ease of access to weapons, and this guy certainly had some, including some things he bought over the internet.
And we're going to talk about that.
Yeah. But I don't think we know enough yet to know about any behaviors that should have set off alarm bells. And I think we got to be careful looking for an easy answer. Usually there isn't one.
Well, in Congressman Al, you know, you've seen the media coverage, obviously. It was hard to miss the media coverage. One of the questions that came up was the 24-hour news cycles obviously grabbed onto this and made it top story. But some critics of the media have come out and saying that there's almost a need to a glorification, not of what he did, but how the media would cover this. Did the media do a good job in covering this? Were they objective, or was there some sensationalism involved in this?
If it bleeds, it leads.
That has been a mantra in the news organizations forever.
For a long time. And if it bleeds a lot, it will be around a lot. It's sad. I don't think that's going to change. I think there are some news outlets that are even more looking for things like that. But you take the reasonably sane ones, let's say the big three, NBC, CBS, ABC, they got to cover it. I mean, after all, it's news. Something that unusual is news. How they cover it, how long they cover it, for how many days they can have breaking news about that issue and that kind of stuff, that's more in the bailiwick of cable television, and they could be more responsible.
Bob, do you agree with him? You being a former member of the board of the National Association of Broadcasters, was the media responsible in a lot of this, or was there a sense of sensationalism going forward in this? There's only so many times that you can report there were 12 fatalities and 58 injuries involved in this horrific attack. But how many ways do you show this?
Well, first of all, I think that Al's right. If it bleeds, it does lead. And this is a terrible, terrible story. But it has to be reported. I think fundamentally the media has done a reasonably good job. I don't see them, at least I haven't seen it. I haven't watched a lot of it, but I haven't seen reporters banging on the doors of people who have family who are in the hospital. So I don't.
Well, there was one instance.
But I know there has been. I'm sure they have been talking to people who will talk with.
Well, there was one instance. The family of James Holmes, the alleged suspect,
yes,
in this incident. The mother of James Holmes was contacted at her home in San Diego at about 4:30 in the morning, San Diego time. She was contacted by ABC, a reporter for ABC, who started saying, hey, what can you tell me about your son? Why is your son involved in this? In a statement that was issued by the family, they felt that was irresponsible and somewhat insensitive to the family of the suspect, who's obviously having to deal with their own issues of grieving. There are instances. Was that responsible journalism, or was that just trying to get a scoop?
Well, might suggest it was both. But the fact of the matter was, certainly they were it would have been better, I would think, that had the family known ahead of time what before a reporter knocked on their door. But I mean, after all, it happened at midnight, and they're knocking on the door at 4:30 in the morning, as you say. So I mean, I'm not so sure they could it could work it out that way. But you know, you got to know that when, on a story this big, where I mean, you have literally, you know, someone acting in a very terrible way and killing a number of people, injuring dozens of people, rigging his apartment as a booby trap, so if anybody opened the door and just walked in, they might have been killed by the explosions or whatever. It really shakes you up to realize how crazy these people can be.
Alan Moore.
In general, I think the news coverage is pretty good. ABC blundered on two different things. One, the one you mentioned, because what ABC originally reported after that story was when basically it said, the mom said, you have the right person. And it sounded like she was saying, oh yeah, that's my son. She came back and said, not only was this a call at 4:30 in the morning, but she knew nothing about a shooting or anything. And the reporter, having just woken her up, said, there was a shooting. There was a person named James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado. Would that be your son? She says that when she said, you have the right person, she was referring to herself, not to her son.
Right.
And that's a massive, massive mistake, assuming her version is true, and hers makes more sense, frankly, than does ABC. But ABC had a bigger problem earlier also in its early reporting, where their top investigative reporter, a guy named Brian Ross, says to George Stephanopoulos in the morning show, what we know is there's a Jim Holmes who joined the Tea Party of Colorado a few months ago. And it took 2.5 hours later for Brian Ross to say, well, it was a different James Holmes. And it took many, many more hours before ABC issued any kind of apology to the Tea Party, to the James Holmes, who innocently
joined the Tea Party.
And even if this James Holmes had joined the Tea Party or Blockbuster or the YMCA, so what? I mean, that kind of linkage was ugly in its intent. And even uglier in the fact that it was wrong and not checked out. That was a black eye.
Congressman Mao, would you call that irresponsible?
No, it wasn't responsible. I think it's interesting how the movies love to really just portray news people in such a terrible, terrible way. And sometimes the news people actually behave that way. And this was one of the instances in which you had overly eager reporters not caring about the feelings of anyone that they were interviewing, and not caring about much else except get it first, get it fast. And that's a case where Hollywood gets it right.
Ralph Winnie.
Yeah, I think when you hear the victims and the families of the victims, they are very concerned about giving the perpetrator any kind of publicity, allowing him to be able to profit from this heinous attack. And I think it's very important for the media to respect and understand the wishes of the victims and make sure that this perpetrator does not profit on it intentionally or unintentionally.
Well, there are laws behind that, but the reality is, right now, Alan Moore is holding up a copy of this morning's Washington Post, where several pictures of the suspect, James Holmes, in his first court appearance in Arapahoe County, really not painting a very pretty picture. And I think that's a little sensationalism, don't you think, Alan?
Well, the president and candidate Romney were both asked by family members not to even mention James Holmes' name in talking about the incident. They don't want to give this guy any coverage because so often there's this narcissistic element where they want to be visible. And they both respected that. And then here's the Washington Post a couple of days later, just because this guy who looks odd with his red hair was in court, never said a word. They not only put one picture, they have four
different
pictures
right
above the fold on page one. What are they thinking? They're going to get just slammed by their readers. okay, he's on TV, you got to show who he is, you can put a picture up there. Four pictures?
I agree.
What's that all about?
And you don't see the victims that died on the front page. Instead,
right.
You see the perpetrator. And that's what the victims and the families are very angry about.
Right.
Why are you giving this guy additional publicity?
Yeah, it's very
strange. And arguably it's feeding into it. But the bigger question here is, and obviously this was led by a discussion that that the mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, independent mayor, had literally the day after on WOR radio, where he basically came out and said that both nominees, both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, need to take a serious look at making gun control an issue now. Many have said that there will probably be, as happens in tragedies like this, whether it's Virginia Tech, Columbine, 9/11, the government has a tendency of having knee-jerk reactions to satisfy the general public in all of this. Congressman Al, is there a possibility, or do you think that the federal government will lay into that and have a knee-jerk reaction associated with some of this? And we're going to talk about the gun control issue in another minute, but is there the possibility that we're going to see a knee-jerk reaction out of Congress like this?
Right before an election? No. Now, the only way it could be done, I don't know why anyone would put this together, but if both candidates, in almost a joint statement, were to come out and say the same thing, it would leave the angry NRA members nowhere to go. But that's not going to happen either. Here is one of the things that I don't understand about the anti-gun focus. They play these issues. And they don't go to, I think, the fundamental flaw in the NRA's argument. The basic NRA argument is, if we allow them to register guns, the government will come and take away all our guns. That is complete nonsense. We register all kinds of things, and people don't come and take them away. They point to Adolf Hitler and all that, but this is not Adolf Hitler's country. You can register guns. You can make it harder to buy them, which in some instances could help. Registering guns helps catch them afterwards. Different laws about buying them might help to begin with. And it's not going to disadvantage a single gun owner in this country if we do it that way. And yet we keep letting the NRA say it will, and their members believe it.
But the NRA does strike a point, Bob Hines, in saying that, it is inherently the Second Amendment right for an American to have the right to possess and bear arms. Now, Bob Hines, that's a pretty stern argument as being, the second of our original Ten Amendments.
Look at the. I can't quote it verbatim, but I can tell you what it says. The need for a well-equipped militia,
regulated
militia, in effect, the right to bear arms exists. Now, I would suggest to you that the last time we needed a militia was some time back, in the normal sense of the word, and I don't know that. I don't know myself. I would say that you could make a very good argument that unless you are part of a official body of
the militia nowadays has turned into what we know as the National Guard.
And unless you were a member of the National Guard, then you would have a much different requirement with respect to just to getting a gun. I mean, you can buy a gun a month in Virginia. You can buy ammunition any place in this country.
Well, we're talking about a gentleman here who bought over 6,000 rounds online.
Online, yeah.
I buy a book at Amazon. This guy buys 6,000 rounds.
Now, let me ask you a question. 6,000 rounds. What are you going to use 6,000 bullets for?
Well, wait a minute. We are talking about whether he uses 6 or 6,000. It is still his constitutional right to have ammunition for guns that he, in all reports that we've seen so far, he acquired these weapons legally. Well, under both state of Colorado and federal firearms laws.
Let's explore this constitutional thing just a little bit more. First of all, from the time of the adoption of the Ten Amendments to the Constitution,
the Bill of Rights,
it didn't mean what the Supreme Court recently said it meant. So that's a kind of a new thing, thanks to this court. Secondly. I don't know of a lot of sensible people who are concerned about guns that want to keep people from owning them. That's a boogeyman made up by and used extremely well by the NRA.
And by the way, if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call in toll free 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713 if you'd like to join this discussion or any discussion that we have on Blog Talk Radio. It's Backroom Politics. Ralph Winnie.
Yeah, I mean, the basic issue that people raise is that you can't keep these kind of weapons out of the hands of sick, demented people like this perpetrator. And when you try to enact gun control laws, you subvert basic freedoms. If you look at the current bans on guns in D.C. and Chicago, it's had no measurable effect on reducing the amount of gun violence.
Well, but Alan Moore, you have to look at the D.C. law. The D.C. law has been overturned.
Right. Well, I was glad that Al reminded Bob that issue of whether it's got to be tied to the militia or not has been settled in the D.C. case. I would also. I'm interested that Al has become is flirting with what he would see as strict constructionism, because he speaks with great certainty about what was intended back when the Second Amendment was written.
Sounds a lot like an originalist, if you ask me.
I don't think we know what was intended back when they wrote the Second Amendment.
I didn't say anything of the sort. I said it meant something else and was accepted to mean something else in legal circles from the time it was put into the first 10 amendments until the Supreme Court changed it.
Bob Hines.
Well, I think we do have a pretty good idea what they meant. They meant that they were to have a militia that was prepared to be available to do what the government needed to have done.
See, Bob is looking back in.
Yeah, and
not me.
That is not...
Wait, hold on. Bob, the
language is relatively clear. You can have a gun if you're part of a well-ordered militia.
Alan Moore.
That's not a very hard thing to
understand. I think we might want to look at that language, because I don't think that if-then construction is quite that clear. I think it is clear that it was thought that you might need a militia. That's part of that amendment. And the notion was, gosh, if there's going to be a militia, then we're going to let people have their guns. But it didn't mean necessarily that you had to get the gun in order to be part of a militia. So I think we just need to be careful about being so certain about what they intended back then.
I'm not
certain. Because we're not.
Well, wait. First of all, if we're going to invoke it, let's state what the text says. The text, in what was ratified by the states and authenticated by Thomas Jefferson, then Secretary of State, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, there are gun control advocates, there are grand organizations that look at this one way, i.e. The James Brady Foundation, but then you look at it from the NRA standpoint. That, into itself, the language that I just read being ratified, there's a lot of inherent interpretation involved in this. Congressman Al.
Of course, Bucky. It doesn't make any difference. Does anybody here seriously think we're going to go back and reinterpret this in the most severe sense along the lines of what Bob Hines has suggested? Basically, nobody can have a gun unless they belong to a militia. No, nobody's proposing that. It's never going to happen. Forget it.
But wait a minute. But how many times does in Aurora, Colorado, or Virginia Tech, a Columbine have to happen before we start looking at definitive interpretation that's involved with this kind of work.
And what I'm suggesting is that if we instead of letting the NRA base the argument on we're going to confiscate all your guns, which is pure nonsense, and start talking about how much you can save if you have to wait 30 days to get a gun, if you have certain rules about selling...
Cooling off periods,
and all of that. But those in no way that I can conceive of take away any rights of any person who wants to use guns for target practice, use guns for hunting, collect guns, use target practice, none of that. You can still do it. It may inconvenience them a bit. Now, how much inconvenience are 12 people worth? I would say
Fair amount. Wait a minute, Alan Moore.
Yeah, you know, I don't actually have any problem with any number of rules, restrictions, registrations, waiting periods, higher tariffs on imported guns. Every Glock made comes from Austria, for example.
And every AK-47 is made by Kalashnikov.
So, you know, I don't have any issue with that. Or ban sale of ammo over the internet. If you buy a gun or ammo in a lot of sites, you have to bring it to a dealer and do it legally, apparently. I don't know.
You have to have an ATF license.
But I don't think that if we had all of that stuff in place, that we can say with any level of confidence whatsoever that this incident wouldn't have occurred, that this guy could easily have gotten his hands on everything he had legally and through channels, because he, so far as we know so far, he wasn't a felon. He didn't disqualify in any way. So I think for Al to say, gee, we're 12 people worth a little inconvenience, is an exaggeration of what likely would have occurred if we did these things, to which I have no particular objection.
Well, first of all, obviously, the 12 people are worth more than a little inconvenience. Secondly, and I should have said it, and I didn't, and Alan is absolutely correct, this is not a magic wand that is going to stop abuse of guns. I think it will help. I think it will reduce. I think it will make less likely. And in time, it may change a cultural perception of the place of guns and things. But it is not the Holy Grail, and I really
admit that. Does this bring into question the assault weapons issue? Does an American, in order for their right to bear arms, do they need an AR-15 in their house for hunting? Do they need an AK-47 for personal protection? Bob Hines.
Well, you have to live in a pretty crazy place to need an AK-47 for personal protection. But the reality is, you can legally buy it. And it sounds to me as though this gentleman, who is the alleged perpetrator in the most recent problem, bought these guns legally,
which he did.
Yeah, and
Ralph.
But
Ralph
is it also not true that you can buy guns at a gun show just by
exchanging money? That is correct.
Yeah. You don't, and the people in the gun show. You can buy more liberally in a gun show than you can in a gun store. Am I correct on that?
Correct.
It varies
by state to state. Yeah. No question. However, it does. You know, if we look at an organization as flawed as it is, like the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the Department of Justice. Every time you sit there and you look at regulating gun shows, the very well-funded and very strong and powerful lobby of the NRA comes back and says, well, wait a minute. This would be a direct violation of our Second Amendment rights and the ability for us to legally, if a gun show dealer is at the gun show and he sells a gun to somebody, that in many states is legal. Why do you need federal protection against that transaction from happening? Does it, in fact, violate our Second Amendment rights for us to bear and keep arms?
Well, if you ask Ron Johnson the question, are gun massacres a fact of life and death in America, which was asked to him on one of the Sunday talk shows, He says, yes, it's a fact of life, because there's no way that we can really control people going out and killing if they are mentally ill. I mean, and whatever gun restrictions you put is just going to subvert the basic fundamental right of being able to bear arms.
That is one of the harshest, cruelest, most insensitive comments I think I've ever heard anybody make about public policy.
Well, I agree with that. It was very disconcerting to hear.
It is true. But to just simply lay back and accept and say anything about it, it's just human nature.
Well, that's going back to the NRA mantra of guns don't kill people, people kill people.
Right. And you have to address the issue of mental illness at some point, but you're going to need to have some sort of limitations on people being able to get these weapons. You hark back 4 years ago in China, before the opening ceremony of the Olympics. You had this mentally ill guy that went into one of the bazaars and he stabbed the brother-in-law of the Olympic U.S. men's volleyball coach. The guy was clearly demented, but because of China's strict gun control laws, he was not able to procure any kind of gun. He was able to procure.
Well, anyway, getting back to Aurora, I think one of the things that we need to focus on, and this brings up also a very legitimate question. You know, this is a guy who also booby-trapped his and used as part of his assault on the movie theater flashbang grenades with tear gas. Now the question is, how did he get a hold of that type of armament? Does that call into question? Is that an armament that would be covered under the Second Amendment rights? Well, there's a lot of people out there that would say it is covered. It's part of that's an armament, and it's part of the right to bear arms. Shouldn't be regulated. I don't know any reason why I should have a class one bang grenade with CS gas in it. That's just insanity. Am I wrong in this, Bob? Or
I don't think you're wrong, but you're talking to someone who doesn't own a gun, has rarely shot a gun, and doesn't like them. You wouldn't want one in my house. I do not know very much about guns, so I'm not the best person to talk about it. But I will say this. It strikes me that we need to find a way to make sure that we meaning this, that the state, the authorities, know where guns are and who's got them. And it's clear that there's an awful lot of guns out there that we don't, that, you know, when you can buy them in gun shows without just buy as many as you want.
But there have been numerous Department of Justice studies done where they show that a majority of crimes involving guns and violence, a majority of them are illegally acquired and illegally in their possession. You know, they're going to get a hold of these guns whether we like it or not. You look at a country like Great Britain, who has some of the strictest gun laws in the Western world, and they themselves will tell you it doesn't stop the fact that people get a hold of guns for the commission of crime. Alan Moore.
That's all true, but I think in this regard, I think what Al's point is, okay, we're not going to be able to stop guns, and there's a couple hundred million guns in America. There are millions and millions and millions of guns. I think half the households in America, or slightly more, have at least one. So it's not like you're going to just suddenly stop it and there's all this traffic. What Al is saying, and this is I do agree with him, that, okay, we're not going to stop guns. The decision, the Supreme Court decision relating to Washington, D.C. is you can't ban them. But it did not say you can't regulate them in any way.
Right.
There are different kinds of regulations in different places. And all Al is saying is, shouldn't we at least, around the margins, try to make it somewhat more difficult, put a few little things in place to reduce somewhat the number and somewhat the ability? And I don't have any quarrel with that. It's not going to solve, it's not going to stop the craziness. It doesn't mean we're going to somehow get rid of violence, but it also doesn't mean we're powerless to do anything.
Well, Congressman Al, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
And what I'm saying is that we're letting the NRA get away with a bunch of bumper sticker logic. You used one just a moment ago. Guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, Ropes kill people, knives kill people, candlesticks kill people, poison kills people, and you know what? People use all of those things to kill people. So you can say that about anything. Ropes don't kill people, people kill people. That is an absolute piece of BS, and we automatically repeat it because it has a kind of logic unless you stop for 3 seconds and think it through.
Well, I'm going to let that be the last statement on this. This is obviously a topic that we will talk about in greater detail as the continued fallout of the tragedy in Aurora, Colorado continues. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the breaking news out of Washington, D.C. The Congressional Budget Office has just issued a report basically giving some numbers attached with the Affordable Care Act. The questions are still out there on that, but we'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Backroom that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
here live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to change topics here real quickly, and we're going to talk about some breaking news coming out of Washington, D.C. This afternoon, the Congressional Budget Office basically made a statement that Obama's health care law will cost $84 billion less than previously expected. Now that the Supreme Court has said that the states do not have to expand Medicaid. However, the statement out of CBO says that it's expected to cost $1.2 trillion over 11 years. However, it will not cover as many people. About 3 million people more are likely to stay uninsured as a result of this. According to the report, and this is a quote out of the CBO as reported by our friends over at Politico and Jonathan Allen. It says, quote, CBO and the Joint Tax Committee now estimate that fewer people will be covered by the Medicaid program, more people will obtain health insurance through the newly established exchanges, and more people will be uninsured, end quote. They continue on by saying, quote, in 2022, for example, Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP, are expected to cover about 6 million fewer people than previously estimated, and about 3 more million people will be enrolled in exchanges, and about 3 million people more people will be uninsured, end quote. Basically, the savings would be a net gain of $88 billion over the term. This is a huge statement coming out of the CBO, particularly with the fact that the increased number of people that would not be covered has gone up to 3 million. That's pretty substantial, Bob Hines.
Yeah, it's substantial. Now, let me ask you a question. There are several states that have in effect said we are not going to accept the money that the government is providing to the Medicaid program.
Correct.
Now, is that where the savings comes from, or is it comes from the fact that the estimates of the number of people covered is less than it was otherwise?
Well, according to the report by Jonathan Allen and Matt Dobius out at Politico, according to their report, will result from last month's Supreme Court, which made it easier for states to opt out of the law's Medicaid expansion program. So it would be the Medicaid expansion that would be the end net result of the savings, but also the end net result of those being uninsured.
Well, you know, you look at it this way, and check me on this. I'm not sure of the exact dates, but the government is prepared if the states set up their exchanges to pay 90% of it. I think it's either 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure which. I may be wrong. But I believe that's it. And after that, it goes down to about 75% or something. So they're willing to pay an awful lot of money. Now, you know, Florida's got a lot of older folks, and probably a lot of poorer folks too. And it's hard for me to see the governor turning all that money down unless they're literally not gonna cover people.
Well, Governor Rick Scott in Florida, as well as Governor Rick Perry in Texas, have already said that basically they will turn down the Medicaid expansion money coming from the federal government as a result of the Supreme Court ruling. That does leave a good chunk of seniors in those states, of which there is a healthy, well, quote-unquote healthy number
There's a large number
of voting seniors in those states that are going to have to pay more. That's a risk. That's a risky call, Alan Moore.
We don't want to mix up Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
The seniors are on Medicare, and that's not going to change by this. What was part of the so-called Obamacare program was an expansion of Medicaid, which is health care for the poor, most of whom would be children and other demonstrably poor people, including some seniors who need to go into nursing homes, and that's not covered by Medicare, but if you're poor enough, Medicaid will pay for you
Medicaid.
In a nursing home.
Yeah.
It will pay for you in a nursing home. That exists today. What is in this bill is an expansion that the federal government would pay 100% of for a period of time, and then it would drop back to a cost-sharing scheme with the government paying the bulk. What the states are nervous about, what they said they're nervous about is, we've seen this kind of a deal before, and Medicaid right now is killing us in its reduced state, if you will. We can enhance it. It sounds good. We're not comfortable with that. What the Supreme Court knocked out was a sort of a hammer requirement, an almost extortion on the states that said, this is what we're going to do for you. If you don't want to take it, you lose everything in Medicaid, including everything you're doing today and have been doing for the last 30 years. And that was what was knocked out. So what CBO has done is said, gee, I wonder what the effect of that will be. Some of these states are probably not going to take that money, and that will save the federal government some money.
Right.
It'll also mean a bunch of people who they expected to go into the Medicaid program won't have coverage. 3 million people won't have coverage, and $88 billion will be saved by the feds. But you know, that's CBO just did the calculations. I don't think there's a big bombshell here. Everybody knew that they have to make assumptions. They don't know exactly what the states will do. This is what they've assumed. Those are the results.
Congressman Al.
It's interesting to me that the two governors who have so adamantly said they won't take the money will be long gone from office when the effect of what they did starts to dawn on the people.
Well, that's assuming that people like Rick Scott won't be reelected and his numbers aren't exactly blowing, you know, the world up right now.
That's right. And governor of Texas and what have you. But it takes a while for these things to get implemented, and then it takes a while for people to say, well, what do you mean over in your state? You mean you get that? We don't get that in our state. And people, you know, ultimately, there's going to be a rebellion in the states.
But when we look at the net result, I mean, when we talk about 3 million people, I mean, there is that one sector that is covered by, and you point this out, Alan, by Medicare and Medicaid, that basically says the situation is you're going to be getting your Medicare coverage and your Medicaid coverage at the same time, but if Rick Scott or Rick Perry basically don't want, if they don't accept that money, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be paying more out of your pocket, money that you're not necessarily going to have.
Well, let's remember, every state in the country has a Medicaid program, and every single one of those Medicaid programs includes poor seniors. That is why Medicaid is the major number one financer of long-term care, of nursing home care in the country. So that wasn't the real target here of this expansion. The expansion was people who don't have any coverage and who aren't insured. It's more kids and younger people who are poor that were going to be pulled in. It's not the seniors. The seniors had it. They're going to keep it. This is really a different cohort of people that's affected.
Does this affect, obviously, they included the CHIP program as part of their study. This is also going to put a lot of kids at risk as well, wouldn't it, Alan?
CHIP exists, Medicaid exists, states are doing what they're now doing, and it's a very expensive program, even though they pay no more than 50%. The percentage share for states depends on the wealth of the states. They get at least half the money from the feds, and they get up to 83% of the money from the feds if they're a poor state, like Mississippi. And then it's everything in between. So the average is about 57%, because the big wealthy states get 50 and the poor ones up.
But when you talk about big wealthy states, though, you're talking about states that are, in the case of Florida, in deep financial trouble.
They're all in deep. Look at California. The big wealthy California is just limping along with massive deficits, and they can't print money like the feds. But we
bring up Florida because of the fact that they are one of the rich states. But the governor said we don't need the money. Keep it.
It's not so much they don't need it. It's that we don't want it because we are not confident that the future is going to be as they say. We think that even our share of 20% or whatever it would end up being in 30% in Florida is more than they want to take the risk. So they'd rather save that money and take their chances with the people who won't get covered.
Congressman Al.
You're seeing the feds may pull back the amount of support.
Yeah, as we talk and, about, gee, we need to reform the entitlement programs. What's that going to mean?
I think that is a fair concern of the states. I serve on the committee in which the chairman of the HELP subcommittee used to love to, when he couldn't meet, right, he said, just chop it out of the doctor's fees, chop it out of, just save and dump it on the states, and anything but raise taxes at the federal level. And we're living with some of that today.
But Bob Hines, it seems to me that they're almost missing the point. You know, we hear constantly, whether it's studies out of HHS, whether we see studies out of the AMA, the number of fraud cases associated with Medicare and Medicaid that are out there. Are we missing the boat? We're so focused on Obamacare that we're not really focusing in on the true money siphon, which is, in fact, Medicare, Medicaid fraud. Is that something we need to take a closer look at?
Well, you know, we need to have a good program for, in effect, making sure that we are chasing as much as we can and identifying any violations of law. But, you know, you could take all the violations you want and put and add them up, and they wouldn't come near, you know, if we got all that money back covering the cost of an expansion of the program.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that there's always going to be corruption, and you have to find it as best you can.
Now, but
we spend millions and millions of dollars trying to root out the cheaters, and they're trying to stay ahead. And you, everyone you find, there's some new one that starts up, and you're going after him. But as Bob says, that's real money. It's not enough money. The real money is in the structure of the program where you get reimbursed for the services you provide. So if you're a doctor who gets cut back on what you're going to get, you have more visits. You order up more tests. And the federal government pays less per test, but you get this volume.
It's more quantity than quality.
This quantity, and it's a problem that they're also trying to struggle with in here, but that's the fundamental flaw in the American system.
But Congressman Al, when we look at that, when you hear what Alan's saying, I mean, inherently then, the other subject that constantly comes up is the complexity of the filing of claims against Medicare and Medicaid. It has now become so complex. Doctors now say they spend two times as much time filing to get reimbursed by the government than it takes them to actually treat and see the patient. Are we missing the boat on that?
My doctor quit. She said, I can't afford to be a doctor anymore. My father's ill in Florida. I'm going to go down and take care of him. Goodbye. I had another example of a woman whose mother was in her 90s, and she was filling out the forms for her. Now, this woman was a rather high-level member of the state, human resources. She spent her whole lifetime working with government documents. She had a hell of a time filling out those for her grandmother, for her mother, who was completely incapable of handling it for herself. So, that there is complexity, no question. Now, when you start asking about complexity, almost every little additional complexity is put in there, usually by well-meaning people, to try to make it a little more fair, or a little help, or help that person, or sometimes by conservatives, you're trying to save a little money. But if you just put it out there and say it's going to be this way and leave it alone, it wouldn't be complex. But if you start tinkering with it, you're going to end up with this complex thing, and then you blame the bureaucrats.
Ralph Winnie.
Well, the question is, how do you streamline the process and ensure that these people don't fall through the cracks, that they are going to get the treatment, medical treatment that they need, and they're not just going to be thrown out on the street?
Well, the way we make law, I don't know whether it can be improved, but a given law is usually a law made over time. start out with one, and then you amend it, and then a couple of years you make the amendment, and then you amend
right.
it, and then you repeal something and add something, and da 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 da. And you never really go back and say, what were we trying to do originally? And let's go back and see if we can pass some legislation that will do that rather than all of these side trips that have developed over the years. I do not expect to live long enough to ever see that happen. I wouldn't live that long if I were only 30 years old.
Probably not. But Bob Hines, it does go on question, has Medicare and Medicaid outlasted its usefulness? Is it time that we come up with a solution that better meets our current medical system and our current economy?
Well, we certainly have a hodgepodge now. And as Al says, we've created things all over the place. I don't know. I have no idea how to do it myself, and I wouldn't even want to try. Maybe Alan, who has worked in this world a little bit more, would be a better person to answer those questions. But my view of the matter is, it's so damn complicated, and it's so damn difficult to deal with today that if we don't clean it up, we're crazy. We need a system that functions a lot better than we have right now. Other countries seem to be able to do it. I don't know why we can't.
Carl Tubin's joined us. Carl.
I think what I hope would happen is that the next Congress, Republicans and Democrats, hopefully will come together, will take a look at the Supreme Court decision. They'll say, this has to be fixed, this has to be fixed, and hopefully they'll get into Medicare and Medicaid and try to do something positive and, as Al says, try to improve things. And see where it goes.
Yeah, but I think that's wishful thinking on Carl's part, but it does bring up the question. Alan, I want to pose the question I posed to Bob. Has Medicare, Medicaid outlasted its usefulness? Is it time to come up with something more modern?
No, I'm laughing because that's what the whole health reform effort was about. It's filled with Medicare and Medicaid and people who fall through the cracks. It's a huge controversy. We've got, as I said, this system where you don't get paid for health results, you get paid for the health inputs of services and tests and so on. But trying to and that works really, really well.
For most of us, absolutely. Okay,
70%+ of the American people like their health insurance. They don't even think about how much it costs, which is a problem. But that's the reason people don't particularly pay attention to what's in the Obamacare proposal, because it's like, don't mess with my stuff. Whatever you're doing over here, just don't mess with mine. And they're nervous that it will. And what the president,
well, they're also talking about the fact that what the Supreme Court upheld is the fact that, hey, I'm going to be taxed on this.
No. They're not going to be taxed.
Wait a minute. I'm talking about what the general electorate are saying.
Well,
they're saying, hey, the Supreme Court says I'm going to be taxed.
If they're that stupid, then it's just another reminder that people aren't paying attention. You know, the Supreme Court said, because it works this way, you can call it a tax. It's constitutional under the taxing authority of the federal government, so it's constitutional. We're not saying it's a good idea. Fine. If from that everybody thinks, oh, my God, there's a new tax here, then they're stupid. They're not paying attention. And, you know, I don't know what you do about that because we, you know, we've run into this question of ignorance before.
Isn't it nice, Alan, not to be running for public office?
Well, I did say if they're saying that, but I don't think most people think it is a tax on them. There are some. It's like, oh, there's a tax. Gee, is that going to affect me? They're not worried so much about that. They're worried about, is it going to change my coverage? I think they're much more worried about reports that are sort of beginning to creep out. But about 10% of American employers are saying,
I'm going to opt out. I'm not going to get coverage. I don't have to.
Probably drop employee coverage and let my employees move in a different direction. And about 80% who have coverage say, no, I'm going to keep coverage. 10% say, I expect a drop. And the other 10% say, I don't know. I'm undecided. I'll see what happens. That's going to frighten people a lot more than the thought that there's some tax here.
But I think the bigger question coming out of the CBO report, Bob Hines, is the idea that, you know, the numbers, and the numbers are going to change. I would not be surprised that in another 6 months we're not going to see another study or another CBO report that's going to come out and saying, oh, you know what, wait, we found another additional 6 million that are going to fall
out. I'd be amazed if we didn't.
Exactly. So, you know, so that number is going to be constantly changing. But it still calls out the question of Obamacare. Did Obamacare truly address the issue of the uninsured? Especially when you have reports coming out about the CBO, from the CBO saying, oh, no, there's going to be more uninsured as a result of Obamacare.
Well,
Bob Hines.
There's always going to be some people who are uninsured. I mean, just there's going to be people who fall through the cracks. I don't think there's probably no way that we're ever going to write a law in this country that's going to cover everybody.
But wasn't the point of the Obamacare to cover everybody that wasn't insured?
No.
I mean, that's what the pundits came out of.
There was always a recognition there would be about 4 or 5% that would not be covered for one reason or another. But there would be an increase in the amount, in the number of people who were covered. That's what the Obamacare bill was all about.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I think the numbers for Obamacare were, this is going to provide coverage to about 30 million more people who aren't now covered, and that's a good thing.
But we have the CBO saying that they're going to cover 10% less.
Correct. What the CBO says is because of the Supreme Court decision, you're not going to get that 30 million, you're going to get 27 million.
Yeah.
And they assume, they're making the assumption that that's what governors will, and legislatures will in fact do. I don't know that that's going to play out. You have governors who say, we're not going to take it. Well, when they are making the hard, cold decision, let's see, are we leaving more money here on the table? These aren't firm, final decisions. These are political statements. CBO has to make a guess. They make a guess. So 27 million instead of 30 million. That's different than what they were hoping for, but that's a result of the Supreme Court.
Carl Tuven.
Rick Scott said when he opted out, he said, you know, we've always been promised money from the government, and it's never there, and we're not sure it's going to be there in the future. And that was one of the reasons why he got out.
Nobody's got out yet.
Alan Moore's correct. What we've heard is the intention. What we've heard is the intention of two governors saying that if presented to them, they will not take the money. That is what their intention is. Nobody has officially opted out of the money. That being said, however, Congressman Al, though, when we look at the numbers, that number still keeps growing. At what point is it maybe 10% off? You know, if not 3 million, it goes up to 10 million. Do we then take another look at this?
What goes up, meaning the number of people?
The number of uninsured. I mean, you're talking about originally the number of uninsured that the Affordable Care Act has been talking about is we will provide medical health care insurance for 30 million additional people who normally would not have coverage. Now that number's down to 27 million, according to the CBO, and I would not be surprised if we see an additional maybe 7 million that would be uninsured.
Might be. Things are going to change, and including the legislation. I can't believe this legislation, assuming it's passed, that there will not be a whole line on the Republican side and a whole line on the Democratic side with people offering amendments to improve it. And some of those will pass and change it. And that will change numbers, and circumstances will change numbers. So you can't pass a bill that's static unless it's thou shalt not kill.
Ralph Winnie.
And then that was going to go to my point. I mean, at what point do you tweak the Affordability Care Act to try and cover these people that are being left out of the process?
Well, I mean, that's going to be a question, obviously, that's going to be continued to be looked at as the Affordable Care Act moves forward into implementation. Ellen, we're going to give you the last word on this.
Final thought. My hunch is that, you know, forgetting everything else in this bill, this is a pretty sweet deal for the states. I'm guessing most states will opt in, and it may be that they'll opt in once they're given a right to drop later if things don't play out in a particular way. That's one of their fears. They can fix that legislatively. So I don't think this number is going to go from 3 up 7 or 3 to 10 or whatever number. I'm guessing it'll be smaller than 3 because states are not going to be able to leave that kind of money on the table. We'll see. This is something out in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's happy hour here at Backroom Politics. Al's very happy. We're gonna order our martinis, order our Jacks and wines and beer, and cut new cigars for our second hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about an event that's happening in Washington, D.C. that hasn't gotten the media coverage I thought it would. It's the International AIDS Conference is being held here in Washington, D.C. It brings up to bear a big question. What is America's role in this, and are we overlooking one of the true healthcare crises globally today? We'll talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. We're going to continue our discussion going into the second hour of our show today about an event that's happening this week in Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. It is the International AIDS Conference that is currently being held in and around various venues in the National Capital Region. This is an annual event that, for the first time, Alan Moore, it's been held in D.C., in what, 16 years? 22 years. It is a subject that has gotten large attention globally, but it seems to have fallen off the health radar here in the United States. Alan Moore, this is a subject obviously you spent some time dealing with, and it's been part of your studies, your work. Why is the International AIDS Conference in D.C. important on a political scale globally?
Well, it's important
This is a conference held every 2 years. It has not been back in the United States. It was 22 years ago. It was in San Francisco. It has not been back in the U.S. because the U.S. passed a law that prohibited visas to foreigners traveling to the U.S. if they were HIV positive. And this was a law passed back when there was still enormous ignorance and fear about the disease and no drugs that would really be assured of keeping people alive for a long time. And many countries have similar laws, most of which changed them over time. And it wasn't until the end of President Bush's term that the U.S. changed the law, and that allowed the conference to come back to America so that people who happened to be HIV positive who wanted to get a visa could come. So that's why it's back in the U.S. Why does America care about AIDS anywhere, particularly overseas? We care because we understand the disease. It was devastating in this country in the 80s and 90s when we were just beginning to identify it, understand it, and realize how many different kinds of ways it could kill. So it touched the lives of Americans, and then we began to realize that whatever it was doing in America, it was doing 10 times over in particularly sub-Saharan Africa, where we now know the virus first originated, maybe 70 or 80 years ago, we just didn't know it. We care because we're a compassionate people who worries about death and dying that's avoidable. We also care because people who have this disease travel, and you don't want a killer disease, a simple tourist airplane ticket away from you. So the extent to which this thing moves uncontrolled around the world, it comes back constantly to harm us.
Congressman Al, when we look at a gathering like this, and you're talking about some of the leading some of the best mind leadership, thought leadership in the subject coming here to the United States, which arguably has one of the greatest research capabilities medically globally. When we look at all of this, is this something that's being lost in the general American electorate, that the fact that we are dealing with a global crisis involving HIV and AIDS?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but then the answer was probably yes to almost any major issue coming along, because the average American is out trying to pay the mortgage and save money to send his kid to college and deal with a variety of family things and his work. So you don't get focused deeply on very many things, and I think this is one of them that doesn't get focused on unless you have a friend who has AIDS or some other way are personally involved. So yeah, I think it's hard to get the average family that doesn't have any association with AIDS to focus on this particularly.
Bob Hines, one of the big questions that has been brought up during this conference is the role of religious organizations and their role in dealing with HIV. One of the ones that, you know, some of them that are being called out are some of the Catholic-based medical research and Catholic-based charities. Because of the stigma that's associated with AIDS and HIV, a large population of drug users here domestically, a large population of HIV in the gay community, there seems to almost be some conflict in the way religious organizations such as Catholic Charities get involved with dealing and researching this problem. Is that something that is a misconception, or is it something that, you know, our faith-based organizations need to take a serious look at and reevaluate the fact that this is a national health crisis?
Well, to me, I think one of the good things about faith-based organizations is generally when they see a problem like this, when they see it and they understand it, they get into it and they try to help. They try to provide programs and assistance and what have you. And I think that's all to the good.
But is there an inherent conflict with that? I mean, you're talking about I mean, again, you know, just doing this, you know, for discussion terms, because this is these are questions that come up when you talk about a subject like this. And Alan, maybe you're the one to answer this. It seems that there's almost an inherent conflict between dealing and researching and providing treatment for HIV by faith-based organizations, you know, because of the lifestyles that have been right or wrong associated with the population that actually contracts the disease.
Anybody who thinks there's a conflict doesn't understand Christianity. Christians care and love their brothers, and it was the role of faith-based organizations, including Catholics, that helped play a critical role in supporting President George W. Bush, Bush 43, back in 2003, to pass this extraordinary global AIDS initiative that surprised everybody, including all the advocates, when he said, let's spend $15 billion over a five-year period and focus it on 14 different high-incidence, high-HIV-infected countries. And I don't, he did it for all the right reasons, and some of those right reasons were support of very conservative Christian groups, including Catholics, and in the delivery of services around the world, you couldn't do what we're doing without the role of faith-based organizations that are oftentimes the healthcare provider in rural parts of poor countries.
Congressman Al.
I think that the Catholic Church comes into it because of its opposition to condoms and some of those uses. But that is not to say that it has been a deterrent to the overall...
Or dormant approach. In their treatment.
That's right. The other thing that should be pointed out is that the evangelicals, who for so long were dealing with social issues such as gay marriage and particularly abortion and all of those kind of things, have moved into the environment, for one, but into this kind of thing, helping people kinds of programs rather than preaching to people and wagging their finger. And that may be the biggest surprise of all.
Well, Ralph Winning.
Yeah, I think you also have to look at certain celebrities that really put their careers and reputation on the line and coming out and pushing for increased AIDS research. You look at Elton John and his support of Ryan White when Ryan White was going through his situation in Indiana where the whole community turned against
Florida.
Was it Florida?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. But then they Elton John ended up helping the family out, not only financially, but helping sort of raise the awareness of the AIDS situation and the impact it has on the family and on the individual. And you had Elizabeth Taylor putting her career and reputation on the line to support her colleagues.
Well,
I think Ralph is exactly right about the celebrity role in this thing, but some things happen together, and we just talked about them all. And each one of those things, the Catholic Church, what George Bush did, what the Lutheran pastor of mine used to call the fighting fundies, the fundamentalists did, have all kind of retarded the fierce foot dragging that was going on in a lot of places. And I think they all helped change attitudes of most Americans toward the whole problem.
Alan Moore.
There were a couple of other things that were happening as well. Some really, really important advances in the science and the availability of drugs that could be given to people with full-blown AIDS that had the Lazarus effect that really kept them alive. And frankly, another piece of this is it wasn't until 2000, 2001 that we really, really began to not be able to ignore the devastation of this disease all over sub-Saharan Africa. One of President Bill Clinton's biggest failures as president was to not be more aggressive on global AIDS while he was president. We can go into the facts. I'll spare you them for now, but he's done fabulous work.
The Clinton Foundation of the Clinton Foundation.
Since he left office, he has done fabulous work. While he was president, for a variety of reasons, there was almost no growth in global spending on AIDS, so that the cumulative need was
extraordinary, and it came to the attention of the Bush administration right after it came into office, and it really began to ramp things
up.
Let's
talk about that for a second, because, you know, a lot of people have a lot of criticism about George W. Bush and his position on social issues, particularly involving programs like HIV treatment, both domestically and internationally. But when we look at the final numbers, George W. Bush did more in supplying international aid in support of HIV awareness, prevention, and treatment. But yet we've seen the Obama administration take a sidetrack backward. Does that surprise you?
No. Okay, quick facts.
Okay.
We identified HIV in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The first money we spent overseas was in 1985 under President Reagan. $1 million. By the end of Reagan, 3 years later, we were spending $40 million. That was a big growth spurt, but not a massive amount of money. At the end of George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, we went from 40 to 120. That was a huge, rapid expansion. 6 years later, 120 had become 140. Almost no growth in the first 6 years of the Clinton administration. That was clearly the big missed opportunity when it came to global AIDS. By the end of Clinton, we were up a little over $400 million. That's what Bush inherited. We now spend about $6 billion. Under Obama, well, what he's had to do is...
$6 billion
per year. Yes, sir. I mean, we have... This growth spurt has been extraordinary. It's flattened under Obama, not because he doesn't care. He does care. And he says the right things. Secretary of State Clinton does the right things. But we have been in this extraordinarily difficult federal budget situation, so it's been a fight to keep spending even, and we've been able to do more with the same amount of money, partly because the cost of these drugs is declining, so we continue to get more and more people onto this life-saving treatment. But I just give you that history.
Most people
would say that George Bush, Republican or Democrat, that either his greatest or one of his greatest or his only good thing that he ever did internationally was global AIDS.
I'll say all three.
but Carl, too.
One of the good things that I like about the conference being here is that evidently there are some really moves to cure AIDS, and that evidently will be announced at this conference. And it's just...
Wait. You're a cure for AIDS. I know there's research going on for possible treatments and possible cures. I mean, there's been talk of one possible quote unquote cure that is still in clinical trials about a bone marrow transplant utilizing a genetic mutation in the bone marrow. That being said, these are some of the innovations that come out every 2 years at this conference. I see where you're going with this, but I want to make sure we're clear. It's not a cure. There is still not a known clinical cure for HIV.
But according to Elton John, they're very, very close to a cure.
That's arguable. But
according to the people who really know, I'm a big fan of Elton John. I think the work he's doing is fabulous.
But I might point out there's none around this table.
Ryan Whitehead was from Indiana.
From the National Institutes of Health named Anthony Fauci has been the head of all of the U.S. government's global aid research spending for the last 20 years. And what he would say, and what he did say, and he has spoken already at the conference, is... We have never seen so much progress in terms of the science. We can now begin to imagine a cure, what we have always wanted, but we are not there yet. There's nothing in clinical trials. There have only been 3 clinical trials of vaccines. The first two didn't work. The first one didn't work at all. The second one actually increased the chance of infection. The third one showed some interesting... like a 30% cure rate, which is significant and huge. In the meantime, we've learned the value of behavioral change, of male circumcision, adult circumcision, and a whole host of other behavioral things, including delaying when you start sex, having fewer sex partners, learning your partner's status, taking the drugs earlier before you or your partner are even sick if you're in risky behaviors, all kinds of things that are going on here to try to create an AIDS-free generation. But there's not a cure yet. We're not on the doorstep of a cure.
But when we look at the HIV issue, I mean, there's two aspects to this. Obviously, there's still the health crisis that's going on domestically, particularly in urban areas. Washington, D.C. has an inordinate amount of HIV cases, particularly among young black males. That is a situation and a crisis that they're dealing with in most major urban areas such as New York, Los Angeles, Miami. There's a health crisis domestically. Yeah, I mean, D.C. is obviously the flagship.
Yeah.
There's more per capita here in D.C. than any other major urban plex in the country. You know, it is truly a health crisis. When we look at that, is that, again, I go back to the question, is this a health crisis that has kind of fallen off because it has been so almost considered a mainstay in our health programs today? You know, AIDS doesn't have the stigma it used to 10 years ago.
Well, I think that's the key. It's no longer a taboo to have AIDS. You can come out and be HIV positive and you can still lead a relatively normal life. You don't have to worry about increased amount of prejudice, which initially happened to AIDS people.
But again, when we look at the health crisis, is there more that can be done domestically? I mean, particularly in the backyard of our federal government here in Washington D.C. There's not a lot of money being spent domestically on HIV.
Oh, that's not true.
Is that not true?
Oh no, we're spending massive amounts of money in the U.S. To prevent pregnant mothers who are HIV positive from passing it on to their babies. We've almost eliminated that, which lets us know that you can do that elsewhere.
Why isn't that work getting out?
Medicaid and Medicare. Well, it, believe me, there's all sorts of efforts to get it to get this word out there. It's helpful for me, because I pay attention to this stuff, to be reminded that a lot of people still aren't really paying attention and don't really know. What's happening today in D.C. is really, really a scary thing, because we have infection rates over 3% among young
black
males, and many of whom are bisexual and are infecting female partners who don't know that they're HIV positive and don't know that they're taking on very risky behaviors. What's different today than 25 years ago is HIV and AIDS was a death sentence, and it scared the hell out of everybody, and there was terrible stigma attached and associated with it because it was thought that it was men having sex with men only, and we've come to realize now that women are at greater risk than men because boys behave badly and women start having sex younger. Oftentimes it's coerced
unprotected
sex, and because it's no longer a death sentence, the men having sex with men and engaging in the most risky behavior think, it won't kill me, I'll take my chances.
Right.
And that is the worst possible
thing. Well, there was a study revealed at this conference this week that says that now the highest risk population domestically is young gay black males. Is this now becoming a young gay black male disease as opposed to what we saw drug users 10 years ago or just your standard gay population 25 years ago?
Well, it is still a disease that can affect anybody. Anybody having any kind of sex with somebody whose status he doesn't know about. If you're in a committed relationship with one partner and you know you're both HIV negative, you're safe. If you're with somebody else, you just don't know. Now, the greatest risk, though, is people who are having lots of sexual partners, unprotected sex, and if it's men having sex with men, there are some physiological reasons that the risk is the greatest of all.
Right.
And in the population here, that puts young black males at the greatest level of risk.
Congressman Al.
I wanted to ask Alan a question.
I didn't realize you were as knowledgeable on this topic as you are. The Washington Post has run several long, large articles on AIDS in the last few days, and I presume that you've read them. One kind of wonders what a young black male in Southeast, whether he's read them. But did you find those to be generally accurate and useful and informative if the public had read them?
Oh, I do. But that's obviously not the way to reach the kind of people we're talking about. That's got to be
campaign,
down in the community, in the churches, through families, leaflets, community health centers, guys in trucks. One of the groups of high risk are intravenous drug users, where the mindset is share needles. Well, that shares blood. And if you got one person who's infected and four people are going to use the same needle, watch out. And this brings up the whole issue of clean needle exchanges and pushing that. And that there are big efforts in many urban areas. There's political controversy about that. But big efforts. Not only in the U.S., I've been in St. Petersburg, Russia, looking at the same street front operation with people handing out clean needles and condoms to drug users who were sneaking around, but they know they should use that stuff. It's a
Carl
one by one long difficult thing.
Question: Will this conference in Washington spur some activity in this country to look at AIDS again in a different way?
It's a good question.
You know, you can only hope that the stories you're talking about, the TV news, will cause some people to pay a little bit of extra attention. I wish, and I have for several years, and to show you how much power I have, you can see here in a moment, I felt that from the beginning, because of the unique nature of the problem here in Washington, D.C., that the president and his wife should get aggressive, assertive, and public on this issue and go into the streets and meet with people, because it would create a whole higher level of
awareness.
Public information and awareness. They've picked other issues, and Mrs. Obama, I'm not being critical because she didn't pick this one, but I wish they had picked this one, because the problem is so unique. It's concentrated in African-American community more so than the others, although it's not absent others. And it's here. It's in their home.
Yeah. Well, one last question for you before we move on is the global threat that HIV poses, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, where it is rampant now, Does that pose a national health risk here domestically, and is that something that we need to be obtusely concerned about?
One of the main arguments that allows this growth in spending to have occurred, from $400 million in 2001 to $6 billion today per year spent overseas, and billions here at home, by the way, is exactly that concern, because the compassionate moral concern is persuasive to some of us, not so much to others. Say, okay, you don't have to buy into that, but how about realizing that the fewer people there are with AIDS in the world, the lower the chances that you and your family and your loved ones will be to be infected somehow, some way, sometime. In Africa, every seriously infected country except one has seen a decline in the rate of infection, and has millions of people alive today who would not otherwise be, either because they avoided it in the first place or they're on these drugs. 8 million people take a drug every day.
Wow.
What's the one country?
Uganda.
Wow.
Which had a lot of early success. So I think, in a way, their early success was probably overstated, and they've sort of fallen back in the last couple of years.
Well, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of great discussion going on in the International AIDS Conference being held here in Washington. I hope that the discussion continues. And Alan, thank you for being our subject matter expert on the panel to be able to talk about a a really important global health crisis that needs that discussion. And we'll talk about this again, obviously, in future shows. I want to go ahead. I'm going to just blow through the last break and just start talking about our last subject tonight, and that's going to be the situation in Syria. The situation in Syria continues to grow and grow into a not only a humanitarian crisis and a chaotic situation there in Damascus, but now the Syrian government has brought up the situation of the threat of the use of chemical weapons, which brings it to a whole new higher level. The new Minister of Defense and the Minister of the Interior in Damascus has said that if attacked by a foreign government, they will not hesitate to use chemical weapons, that being a direct ploy at Tel Aviv. This now brings it to a whole higher level, Bob Hines. Bob, this has got to be something that has got to be on the radar over there at the Pentagon and in Congress.
What Assad here, his prime minister or foreign minister, has said is that if any foreign troops, you know, come in, they will use their chemical weapons. And I think that is, I think we are to the end game.
Is it an act of desperation by the Assad government in Damascus?
Yes, it is, because using chemical weapons. Let's assume that he thought that would be that would keep, let's say, the UN from sending troops in or something. Look, the troops are going to be among the people. They're going to be where the fighting is, where the difficult. And he's going to start killing. He's going to be killing his own people. He is, and he doesn't. Obviously, he doesn't care. But using chemical weapons, I think, would be a step that would probably, just the concept of kept using chemical weapons, would be something that would just would blow him out of the water.
Congressman,
and I think he is. I think this is his death rattle right now.
Congressman Al, I mean, obviously the Assad government is in a state of turmoil. It's a situation where they're more than likely grasping at straws right now. But when you look at it from as a member of Congress, is this something that is going to sway you either way, or at least give you thought for pause when you look at use of force in a place like Syria?
The general reaction is in Congress is going to be one of anger, and I understand it completely. My gut is this, and I often do not follow my gut, but my gut is if there was ever a time to unleash Netanyahu, now is the time.
Is that a smart play?
I think it is absolutely stupid play. But it is one that satisfies the outrage in you that Syria is doing all the things it's done, and secondly, that it would threaten that. So you got to tamp down the emotions of Congress that I think are very angry about this, so that hopefully no one introduces a resolution to do something awful. Or that the administration, and I think this is less likely with Mrs. Clinton, do something quietly and whisper in Netanyahu's ear, go ahead and blast away.
Is there a threat right now, Alan Moore, that we may just unleash the junkyard dog that is Tel Aviv and Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, I don't think we would ever want to be perceived as unleashing anything, as though, and I don't think that Israel would want to have it be perceived that we have the power to unleash them.
But the influence that Washington has in Tel Aviv.
I'm not saying we don't have some influence. The question is, what are we prepared to do to sort of back him up? We don't. Remember, this was the first time that the Syrians have ever actually acknowledge that they have these weapons. We knew they had them, but it's very different when he says, we're not going to use these for anybody internally, only to external enemies. Well, if you're on the border of Syria, like Turkey is, and Israel right there, these people are saying, what do we have to do to protect ourselves? What are they saying to us? I'm guessing we're saying, hang in, hang on, be calm. Maybe we put more planes in the air or something. I think I'm not terribly impressed with the course we're on, but I'm very understanding of the politics, because the American people, by and large, don't care.
They don't know much. They don't care much. That's over there. We just, it's one more country where we might get into trouble. We're not feeling any great threat. And the politicians in America know that. So you've only got a handful saying, we need to arm the rebels, arm the rebels, arm the rebels. That's not a groundswell. I think we're just hoping and praying that by staying this uncertain course, that Assad will step down and somehow we can secure these weapons. I think if Israel were to become the aggressor and try to take this stuff out, it could backfire, not just on Israel, but on the rest of us.
Ralph, when the statements coming out of Damascus, out of the Assad administration, that's obviously got to resonate with Beijing and Moscow. Does Beijing and Moscow now say, well, wait a minute, you didn't tell us this. You're on your own, pal.
I think it's increasingly likely that they're going to think they have a skin in this game now and recognize that this guy has to go. The worst thing is for these chemical weapons to fall into the hands of Hezbollah, and I think even the leaders of Russia and China acknowledge that that would be a great threat to
is that going to be enough for them to back possible UN sanctions and U.S. Security Council action? Will they veto now as a result of the last statement?
I think it's increasingly likely. I mean,
that they'll veto or they'll support
that they'll support a UN resolution to go in and get this guy out, because no one can risk Hezbollah getting their hands on these weapons.
But Bob Hines, this now calls into question a bigger situation. Is does international involvement now get involved to secure the chemical weapons, or do regime change, or both?
Well, number one, I think that if you're going to have international activity, the first thing you have to do is you've got to get the Arab League behind you, just like we did with Libya. You've got to have the Arab League, the local policeman, if you will, the local political operation, they've got to be there. At that point, if the Arab League, in effect, came out in support of a UN resolution and was willing to state, you'd have the same kind of, I think, quite frankly, China and Russia would want to back off at that point because they have some friends they don't want to make unhappy. And I think also that at that point, the smartest thing we could do would be to try to find some way to get somebody in there to talk to Assad and say, look, you got to get out of here. You're going to be killed if you're not. You know, where do you want to go? You got plenty of money someplace. Go and hide with it.
Was this a knee-jerk reaction possibly to the bombing that occurred at the Defense Ministry?
What was a knee-jerk reaction?
The statement of the use of chemical weapons?
I think you could say that. I mean, I think what it is a statement by Assad's team, you know, we're going for the max. You know, you're going to have to really have you got a real problem if you're going to come and get me. But, you know, I think it's just a bully's statement.
Do you think that they are fully prepared to use? We saw Saddam Hussein use it against his own people back in the late 90s or back in the mid 90s.
Yeah, he was in charge then.
Are you saying that Assad is not in charge?
No, I'm saying he's losing it, and he doesn't. He's losing it, and I don't think that he wants. Let me put it this way: were he to use chemical weapons, who would take him in? Where could he go?
Interesting. Hold on, Carl Tubin.
Yeah, there were a few people on television this past weekend talking about this subject, of course, and they claimed that they thought it was a few weeks or a month before Assad goes, that these were Syrians, that opposition has gained a lot of strength because of the bombing in that ministry and the killing of the three people. And they also said that the communities that are into this revolution are forming kind of little councils. And those little councils throughout the country will help bring a government to the new Syria. When it happens, I don't think I don't think there's any effort in Israel at all and any want of taking on Syria at this point. They're angry enough at Iran, and hopefully they won't do anything that's going to...
Are you saying that Israel, in your opinion, Israel doesn't have a plan to thwart off any sort of hostile actions by the Assad government?
I don't think so, no.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Well, if you take Netanyahu's position, you have to expose those who stand behind terror, and that would be calling out Iran for their support of Hafez al-Assad. And I do agree with Bob's point. You're going to have to send someone in to negotiate with Assad, and that could be someone from the Arab League, and that would probably be fairly effective.
Yeah, but now we're talking about a situation going off the fact that if we do have to invoke, governments that are not necessarily friendly to the American position, i.e. Iran, do we in fact now at this point, Congressman Al, invoke the friend of, the enemy of my friend is my friend, or the friend of my, whatever the hell, you know what I'm trying to say. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
A mind is a terrible thing to
learn. Yeah. That's what happens when you become the moderator and you smoke Jack and smoke Jack. You know what
I'm saying? I have no idea what you just said.
All right, hold on. Take two. Congressman Al.
Yes.
Are we now getting into a situation where the enemy of my enemy is my friend? Are we in fact in a situation where we may have to sit down and invoke Iran as a possible swager to the Assad government?
I see no reason why Iran would be reliable in any regard.
No.
So the answer is no.
Okay, very good. Alan Moore.
Well, if somebody was going to talk to Iran, it would not be us. But the Russians might be in a position, if they are starting to rethink, as Ralph is suggesting,
right,
that they would look around in some different directions than we would, and they might have some conversations with Iran.
Interesting.
The Arab League is meeting either this week or next week.
This week, I believe.
Yeah. And they're, one of the things they're considering is the Palestinians want to be a non-member state of the United Nations. But they really ought to, as we've all said, Bob said, they really ought to concentrate on Syria and figure out how they're going to get rid of Assad rather than the other. And
right.
That should be the top thing on their agenda.
And I think they will now, because Assad has come out and threatened to use chemical weapons.
I mean, I think that's a huge mistake to make that threat.
Yeah.
Because once you make that threat, almost everybody.
You can't unsay that.
No, and you're in a terrible position at that point, because if you use them, then all bets are off. I mean, people wouldn't mind if they dropped it.